Well, what a thrill to be here, and particularly sitting alongside Professor Lewis, who's a titan in this field. This is sort of an interesting moment for me. I've given at least 100 speeches about Iran. I've given many, many speeches about Iran all over the country. Like most people who give speeches, I'm usually the person in the room that knows the most about the subject. There have been some occasions when I've given speeches where there have been a couple of people in the room that are either Iranian or are scholars of Iran. So I might not have been the only person in the room or the most knowledgeable person in the room on the subject. But this is definitely the first time I've given a speech about Iran when every other person in the room knows more about Iran than I do. So therefore, I will not try to speak to you about Iran, but something that I can perhaps enlighten you about, which is my own encounter with Iran, which is interesting partly because it's Iran, but also because it's about the interplay between academic scholarship and popularizing journalism and history, which I think is a very interesting nexus. My engagement with Iran began truly by accident. As you heard, I was the New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul, and like all New York Times bureau chiefs, I had a beat. So I was assigned to cover Turkey and a certain number of other countries. I tried to learn as much as I could about those countries, and I'm very interested in history and culture. So I immersed myself in the stories of those countries, but Iran was not one of those countries. So I didn't really make Iran part of my little family of countries that I focused on when I was in Istanbul. One day the phone rang. A lot of great stories begin that way. One day the phone rang, and it was my boss in New York, the foreign editor. And he told me that the person that normally covers Iran for them had some problem. Can't even remember the details, whether the person was sick or couldn't get a visa or something. Anyway, the guy said, there's going to be a presidential election in a couple of weeks in Iran, and we need somebody to go, and you're it. So go get yourself a visa and go to Iran. That's actually not such an unusual thing to happen to a foreign correspondent. It's always a little bit intimidating, but we're used to dealing with that. It's often said that a journalist's knowledge is a mile wide and an inch deep. And so I was willing to try to work myself down to that one inch and get to Iran. I was able to get the visa. You know, it's very interesting in Istanbul. Many of you have obviously been there. Because Istanbul was the former capital of the Ottoman Empire, the consulates that are now in Istanbul, since the embassies are all in Ankara, are the former embassies. And many of these consulates are far grander than the embassies, especially the ones of the countries that were important in those days, like Sweden and Holland have huge, very elaborate embassies, or they're now consulates in Istanbul, Russia also. But the Iranian embassy is not located there. Being a Muslim empire, Iran was allowed to have an embassy in the Muslim quarter, which was then the real center of the city in the Nonu. So you have to go over to the other side of the Golden Horn and wait for your visa in a somewhat different surrounding than you do when you're waiting for those in the western, what used to be the Christian part of Istanbul. So I went over there, I got my visa. At that time it was fairly open. That was the election in which Khatami was running. And many journalists were coming, and the regime was understanding that they were coming and was open to them, so there wasn't really a big problem. I was able to get to Iran about 2 weeks before the election, and I spent those 2 weeks traveling everywhere. I got in a car, and I had a photographer with me, and we had just sort of picked up people who could help us interpret, and we just traveled all over Iran. That was a completely fascinating, eye-opening experience. Now, not only was I not an expert on Iran, but I also really wasn't an expert on the Middle East, because all the Arab countries were also outside of my beat. I was not covering Arabs, I was not covering Israel, I was not covering any of those countries. My beat was Turkey, the Caucasus, and Central Asia. So I've never really studied the Middle East, although I've tried to immerse myself deeply in other countries that I've been assigned to cover. I did know one thing about the Middle East, though, which is that most countries in the Middle East are what you might call fake countries. They're just made up by British diplomats drawing lines on maps in men's clubs at Pall Mall. It didn't take more than 24 hours for me to get to Iran to realize that this does definitely not apply to Iran, that Iran is the exact opposite of a fake country. Iran has such a deep sense of itself. It's not just the length of its history, but it's the depth of people's awareness of their cultural and historical background that just knocks you out when you get there. How can I put this very gently? The Turks, as you know, let's say that their love for Arabs has some limits. Can we put it that way? And I found a very similar situation in Iran. Actually, Iran and Turkey have wound up being the only two countries in that part of the world that really interest me personally. What happened to me when I got to Iran? Well, first of all, of course, I was caught up in covering the election, and that was a fascinating story because when I got to Iran 2 weeks before the election, nobody had ever heard of Mohammed Khatami. And by about 9 days later, the entire country was in a frenzy for him. It's so different from American elections where it starts years in advance. So the news story itself was fascinating. But for me, actually, even more interesting was the discovery of this fantastic country. Something happened to me that happens often it always happens to me when I'm going to a new country. I always ask myself, how did this country get this way? So why is this country rich and powerful? Why is this country poor, miserable? That question immediately came to my mind. There's an obvious contrast, even for an ignorant person that comes to Iran, between the tradition and the heritage and the sophistication and the depth and the breadth of Iranian culture and life and history on the one hand, and Iran's status as a kind of a pariah country that's never able to fulfill itself, where so many of the best people are out of the country and it's poor. And there's a big disconnect between what you would think Iran should be in the modern world and what Iran is. So why is that? How did that happen? This question surged into the front of my mind as soon as I got to Iran. The more that I talked to people and the more I read about Iran, which I immediately started to do as soon as I got home, the more I realized that a big turning point in the history of modern Iran, to put it mildly, was the 1953 coup in which Prime Minister Mossadegh was overthrown. Upon realizing this fact, I immediately wanted to go out and buy a book and find out about the coup. What happened? Imagine my surprise to learn that nobody had ever written such a book. There had never been a book about the coup against Mossadegh, certainly not in English. But I was still interested in it. Just the fact that there wasn't any book was not enough to make me lose my interest, because I was trying to figure out, I'm trying to answer really questions for myself. I was trying to figure out why, what happened. And then the Americans were involved also. That got me even more interested. So I realized that the only way I was going to be able to read this book would be if I would write it myself. I set out to do that. It was really a fascinating experience. I can remember at the beginning, I came to realize what a huge event this was, and not only for Iran, but also for the United States and the region and the development of the idea of democracy in the Muslim world. But yet, nobody had ever written about it. And I remember thinking to myself while I was writing the book, you might write a better book than this sometime in your life. You might write a book that sells more copies than this one at some point. But you are never going to find a story that is this big and this unknown. There's such a disconnect between what a big story it is in the history of the 20th century and how little it's mentioned. You can buy almost any big encyclopedic history of the 20th century in English, and you won't even find a mention. Maybe there'll be one line about this. it's sort of completely fallen out of the historiography of the 20th century. While I was writing my book, I called the guy who has written the multi-volume official authorized biography of Winston Churchill. Plus, he's spent another few decades editing all the Churchill papers, and he's Mr. Churchill. And I wanted to get his take on it, because, of course, Churchill had a very important role. And to my amazement, he too said, "Oh, yeah, it was Churchill. I guess I did think he or she was involved in that in some way, but yeah, I don't really know. No, I don't have anything. I don't ever saw anything about it." I was shocked. So all of this was exciting me as I was writing the book. Soon after beginning the project, I also learned that Mossadegh had been on the cover of Time magazine, as many of you know. And so I managed to find an actual copy on eBay of that Time magazine. And I got the cover, and I had it framed, and I put it up in my office where I do my writing. So he was looking over my shoulder, almost literally, while I was writing this book. That Time magazine cover, in those days, they understood that the figures they put on the cover were so well known that they never put the person's name. So it doesn't say Mossadegh on the cover, but you get this very beautiful picture. Actually, it's a beautiful cover with you see the oil derricks in the Iranian on the Iranian heartland with a big fist coming out of the desert like this. And the title. So they don't put the name of the guy, but they always put some title at the bottom. And of course, the loose headline writers are trying to figure out something clever, but also something that will make their point. And the headline under the title under the Mossadegh cover says, "He oiled the wheels of chaos." They called him a dizzy old wizard. I had the feeling that Mossadegh was looking down over my shoulders and saying, "Tell my story. Bring me back to life." Truly, he had become a completely forgotten figure in America. Nobody had ever heard of him. Maybe that may be different in other countries, and certainly in Iran. But I remember saying to my mother, "I'm writing this book, and it's about an Iranian leader, Mohammad Mossadegh." And she said, "Isn't he the one who cried?" You might remember that Mossadegh sometimes gave speeches to the modulus, and he'd be so carried away with the suffering of the people, the brutality that was being visited on us, and the unfairness, and the British, and they're crushing us, and he would start really, I think, legitimately weeping. He was a very theatrical person, but he was also very emotional. And I think in Iran, of course, this would have not seemed silly or foolish, but in the West, of course, it was used to ridicule him. And I know that a couple of times he passed out from the emotions of some of his speeches. And when he came to the U.S. in 1951, Newsweek described him as the fainting fanatic. So all my mother knew was that he was the guy that cried, which is more than most people in America would have remembered. She was living in New York at the time that he came to the UN in 1951. But when he came, now that I've researched it, it was a huge deal. He was on all the magazines and newspapers. He took a cab home from the airport. He didn't want to take a limousine. He was very frugal. He never took a salary. When Kleenex were introduced in Iran, he used to peel them apart because he thought it was a waste to use the two-ply. He always, particularly when he was in the United States, tied his struggle to the American Revolution. "We're only trying to do just what you did. We want to get the British out, and we want to take control of our own country and our own resources." After he spoke at the UN, he went to Washington and had a series of meetings with officials there, including President Truman. He was something of a hypochondriac, in addition to having a lot of real ailments. I've never been able to figure out where the line was, although some doctors tell me there really is no line. Though invited to stay at Blair House,
He chose to stay at Walter Reed Medical Center, where he was subjected to all sorts of tests that he thought were great. He just was very happy there. He received many of his guests there. As you know, he received many of his guests in bed, even when he was back home in Iran. But what I also thought was really interesting about his story was that he took the train from New York to Washington, and he had the train stop in Philadelphia so he could go and visit the Liberty Bell. And a photograph exists of him and the mayor of Philadelphia standing next to the Liberty Bell with Mossadegh kind of putting his finger in the crack. And I think he was doing this, it was kind of a theatrical, although I think authentic, attempt to show that I'm connected to what you did. And when he got to Washington, the only place that he wanted to visit, other than his official functions, was Mount Vernon. All of this I learned as I was trying to bring him back to life. In the popular storytelling mode, of course, you play up things like this. And I made Mossadegh into the fantastic character that he was. He wasn't just an important political figure, an ideological figure, but also a very interesting embodiment of his nation. You know, if you want to break it down very crudely, Iran has sort of three paradigms for government: a military-backed dictatorship, religious rule, and secular-style democracy. Mossadegh being the paradigm of the latter. I spent quite some time immersing myself into everything that had ever been written about Mossadegh and picking out pieces from other scholars' work. My books are not heavy on original research, but I'm big on connecting things that haven't been connected before and putting things together in different places. This was what nobody had ever done about Mossadegh. The material was out there, particularly after the CIA study of how we overthrow Mossadegh was leaked in 2000. That's quite a lengthy document. It was used to train future agents who are going to go out and overthrow government, so that's quite a detailed description. And then the story of the oil nationalization and so forth has all been told. But I came across some fascinating nuggets. I'll just see if I can come up with one or two. Here's one story I found out. In the book that Kermit Roosevelt, of course, was the CIA agent who was sent to Iran with the job of overthrowing Mossadegh. He was the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt. It's another great little trick of history. A guy that was involved in overthrowing regimes at the turn of the century, his grandson winds up having the job to overthrow one half a century later. He wrote a book about what he did. And in that book, he talks about many times that he went to England and met with officials of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company to coordinate with them what he was going to be doing in Iran. So while I was at a conference in Oxford that was held about this coup, in which the last surviving participants in the coup actually appeared, which is another very interesting story, I met a guy who was a senior official of Anglo-Iranian, now BP. I don't buy BP, by the way. That's my one remaining protest. When you go into Oak Park, there's a mobile station and a BP station. Now, mobile would not be considered the exemplar of good corporate behavior in the world. And are they any better at all than BP? Of course not. But nonetheless, I feel good by not going into the BP station. So this guy said, I asked him about this book, and so he told me the following story. He said, I became chairman of BP when that book came out. And I had never understood or realized that the company was involved in the coup. So when I took over, I called in one of my assistants and I told him, I want you to go through all of our files and talk to everybody you can find, and I want you to write a report for me on exactly what was the role of our company in the 1953 coup. And so the guy got on, did all his research, and he came back and he said, you were right. We weren't involved at all. Everybody tells me this. All the documents point to the same conclusion. So he said, I was quite mystified by all this. When then one day, when I was out at Sir So-and-so's house up in Twickenham, who should appear at the party but Kermit Roosevelt? So I went over to him and I said, I got a question for you. In your book, you're talking about coming to meet with the BP officials or the Anglo-Iranian officials all the time. But yet, as far as we know, we never met with you. What's the story?
And Kermit Roosevelt told me,
ah, when I wrote my book, I had to turn it over to the CIA for censorship. And Nate, at that time, MI6 was even more secretive than the CIA. Nobody knew who the head of it was. It had never even been acknowledged to exist. And so they said, it's absolutely impossible for you to mention that you were going over to England. Every time you went to England, you're meeting with the MI6 agents. We could not allow that at all. But I had to say I was meeting with somebody, so I just took out MI6 and I put in Anglo-Iranian oil company officials. So you were right. You were not involved. But I had to say that because the CIA wouldn't let me tell the truth that it was the MI6. So that's some, I guess that counts as original research. It's not in, it's not dusty like a lot of original research is. So I really feel that I succeeded in bringing Mossadegh back to life. I flatter myself to believe that most Americans alive today who've heard of Mossadegh, at least if they're under the age of 60, they've heard about it from my book. My book has sold hundreds of thousands of copies. It's been I've been invited into so many Iranian American homes, and the hospitality and the food is so fantastic. I had the same experience when I wrote my book about Turkey, and then I began to think, you know, I should pick my countries by the cuisine. just write about countries that have fantastic food. I wanted to write my next book about Indonesia, but I don't even know. I can hardly find Indonesia on a map, so that might be a stretch. So I did develop a great feeling for Mossadegh, and I'll tell you, the chapter in my book that I get the most comments about is the last chapter. So in the final chapter of my book, the whole story's over. So Mossadegh's been overthrown, and then the final chapter takes you up everything that happened since then, and I talk about all the long-term effects, and I think they're very profound. I do think it's not far-fetched to draw a line from the coup of 1953 through the Shah's repressive rule to the explosion that we call the Islamic Revolution. Then that revolution, of course, terrified the Soviets because they were afraid it would trigger also fundamentalist revolutions all along their southern flank. Yeah, that was part of what motivated them to invade Afghanistan. That's what brought us into the Afghan quagmire. That helped produce the brew from which Al-Qaeda and September 11th emerged. So I do think this is a profoundly important episode. But after finishing that part of the book, so the book is over. And then I have a last chapter where you are introduced to a new character who has not appeared in the book up to then, and that's me. I go to Iran on the trail of Mossadegh. I'm trying to visit sites associated with him, and I ask everybody I meet, what do you know about Mossadegh? And I go to his house, and there was an attempted coup earlier where this Shaban the Brainless drove his car through the gates. That gate was salvaged when the house was burned and brought out to Ahmadabad, and I put my hand on the gate, and I'm thinking of all the history this gate has seen. I get more comments about that chapter than any other part of the book. So that book has been a huge success. It's been it's been pirated into three different editions in Iran, and what I've been told by people that have read them is that the translations are roughly accurate, if not high standard, but there's one big difference. The principal religious figure at that time, Ayatollah Kashani, began as an ally of Mossadegh. But then, for a variety of reasons, they split. Kashani became not only an opponent of Mossadegh, but a participant in the coup. He had received a $10,000 payment from Kermit Roosevelt just a couple of days before the coup, and used that to help mobilize forces that helped overthrow Mossadegh. Ayatollah Kashani's son is now a big figure in Iran. As a result, my book now portrays Kashani as a victim of the coup of 1953 instead of a perpetrator. So that's been the big change. People have read my books in Persian have told me that's the big change. He's switched over to the other side now. So I'm very happy that I still feel my relationship with Mossadegh. Not everybody that I write about is admirable, but I really think Mossadegh, although he has his own flaws, was an admirable figure. He was a profound Democrat, which I think was part of the reason why he was overthrown. Had he been the person that we said he was, a tyrannical dictator with communist backing, he would not have been overthrown. He was overthrown because his society was so open that it was very, very easy for the CIA to penetrate it and overthrow it. And that coup was so easy that as soon as Kermit Roosevelt got back, he was told the CIA wants to do this again in Guatemala, same thing. And that just took 10 months before they did the same thing to Arbenz in Guatemala. And they did it the exact same way. He was a Democrat, and he had an open society. Che Guevara, you know, was in Guatemala at the time, and his message to Castro was, let me tell you what I learned in Guatemala. You cannot impose a social justice program in any country the U.S. is interested in a democracy, because they'll come in and overthrow you. It can only be under a dictatorship. And I think that's what motivated Castro to establish a dictatorship, in addition to some other reasons as well. And in fact, I'll just tell this one little story. I met the guy who was the last surviving Arbenz cabinet minister. And I took him aside after this conference that we both participated in. I said, I have a question for you. Just before your government was overthrown in 1954, the government of Iran had been overthrown. They did it the exact same way, and more or less for the same reason. Just take out Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, put in United Fruit Company. It was more or less the same paradigm. What did you know about what had happened in Iran? Didn't you draw any lessons from that? How closely were you following that? And he said, I got to tell you, in 1953-54, if you were living in Guatemala, Iran might have been on Mars. Nobody even ever heard the word Iran. Mossadegh, coup. We didn't even know it had happened. It was very, very vague to us. We had no idea about it. And I think that was another advantage that the CIA had in dealing with these sort of naive leaders who didn't understand how their actions would look in Cold War Washington. So let me just finish by making this one other observation. There have been a number of, not a big number, but there have been several scholars who have worked on Mossadegh and the Mossadegh coup over a period of 20 years. None of them has concentrated on it as his main interest, but a couple have gotten more and more interested in recent years, but all have done pieces of it. People that have written about the history of the oil industry in Iran. Naturally, the coup is in there. I remember digging out a couple of interviews with people who participated in the coup and were long dead in an academic article in the journal Science and Society, which I don't know if anybody ever reads, but there were nuggets out there. And I benefited from all this. Had it not been for those scholars, I wouldn't have been able to write my book. Because my contribution to this process was to collate all this material, put it into an exciting narrative that people would want to read. My contribution was not discovering lots of new facts. So, how did those scholars react when some guy that hadn't even heard of Iran 5 years ago starts selling huge numbers of copies of his book thanks to all the research that I did? Well, it's been an interesting experience. I would say that they run the full gamut. It's basically both extremes. I've had encounters with scholars who have done some writing on this issue and whose work I used, who have essentially told me, I'll paraphrase them, look, the whole point of research is to spread knowledge. And that's what scholars are for. That's the main thing we do, is we collate knowledge and we add to the sum of human knowledge, and we want to spread knowledge. And if my work leaked into the popular consciousness thanks to your book, it's great, because all it means is that more people know about the subject, and that's what we all want. But not everybody feels that way. I've had some scholars that are not happy at all. They feel like I kind of ripped them off, and that just some amateur has come out here and sold a couple of 100,000 copies by looking at my article in Science and Society. And why? I always go out of my way to express my debt to these scholars. I do it in the introduction to my book. Anytime I'm in an audience, I'm speaking to an audience where any of them is present, I go out of my way to express my fealty and my gratitude to them. But even when I did this at one conference in Chicago, the guy would not come out to dinner with me afterward. And he told people that this was the reason, and he's still pissed off. There's nothing I can do about that, but it is an interesting footnote to the story of how academic
research and sort of journalistic popularizing mesh and don't mesh. If the journalist's knowledge is really a mile wide and an inch deep, the scholar's knowledge might be described as an inch wide but a mile deep. And there's a huge value to both of them. They're both very important. Some scholars, I think, have a problem with that. Sometimes I've had my books reviewed by scholars, and they use the word journalistic to describe them. It took me a while to realize that this was not intended as a compliment. We, however, do the same thing. Journalists might write a book review and say, this was a good book, but it was a little academic. So we sort of return the favor of the insult. But these are two great worlds, and I really feel that I'm kind of straddling the two, and I owe a tremendous debt to scholars, and I think for all of you that are looking forward to this as a career, the possibility that your work can be then used by people who have a larger access, let's say, to the popular audience, even though we are not qualified as serious scholars, should be something you should take very positively and take the guy out to dinner afterwards. Thank you. I'll be happy to respond to any of your assaults or questions.
Well, I guess I'm curious to know why you think the story of this coup has fallen popular.
Very interesting. I would first of all say that it's not just the story of the Mossadegh coup that Americans don't know about. They don't know about the Arbenz coup either. Not very many people know anything about how the U.S. came into possession of the Philippines, for example. About our war against Sandino in Nicaragua, how we overthrew Zelaya in 1910, and everything we did, and how we created Panama to take the canal. So I put the Mossadegh coup in that basket. I think the reason we don't know much about it and we don't write much about it is that it doesn't portray us the way we like to think of ourselves. I sometimes think this is one of the reasons why there's such a huge fascination in America with World War II. Of course, World War II was a massive episode in the history of the 20th century. Nonetheless, if you could stack up all the books that have been written in America alone about World War II, they'd probably span the earth at the equator. I think that at least part of the reason for this is that World War II portrays us as we want to be portrayed, as we think of ourselves. We fought against evil tyranny to establish democracy. We wouldn't like to be told that that was actually the exception, and that most of the times we've done the opposite. In more than a few cases, and the Mossadegh case is a great example, we overthrew people who embraced what we would call fundamental American principles. And we replaced them with tyrants who despise everything the United States stands for. We don't want to see ourselves that way. And I think nations are like individuals. We think very well of ourselves. I'm a really nice guy. Everybody, if you got to know me, you'd really like me. If you didn't like me, there could really only be two explanations. One would be that you don't know me, you haven't gotten to know me. Or the only other explanation could be that you're a real jerk. And naturally, you wouldn't like me, because I'm not a jerk. I'm a nice guy. A jerk wouldn't like me. Countries think of themselves the same way. There's only two reasons why whole populations or individuals in foreign countries would not like the United States. One is that they don't get us. They don't realize who we are and what we do. Or the other is that they're brutal. They're dictators. They hate freedom. Wasn't that they hate our freedom? Remember that line? The idea that a nation or a population or a group or even an individual in a foreign country would understand the United States very well and not like us,
a person who was a good person, who was a patriot and a nationalist, who knew about America and was anti-American? No, this does not fit in. This is not possible. And so I think that nations, like individuals, like to see themselves portrayed as they believe they are. And the Mossadegh coup contradicts that, as do a number of other episodes in American history. And I think that's one of the main reasons why we don't talk about it. Had it come out differently, had the Shah turned out to be a Democrat, and then had there been more elections, and Iran had sort of continued on the democratic path, then we might be hearing about this. Because then there would be a whole different historical narrative that Mossadegh was a bad guy, but we always preserved the democratic system. But that didn't happen. In fact, I heard one of the CIA agents who participated in this coup, who was also involved in the Arbenz coup, say our big mistake in both of these cases was after the coup was over, we just lost interest in the country. We didn't care what happened afterward. I would put it a little bit differently. I would say that after we overthrow a government that we don't like, and this certainly fits in with in Iran, we want to put in a new regime that fills two qualifications. One, it should be someone who's popular, who can sustain himself in power, someone that people like. And the other is it has to be somebody who'll do what we want. We certainly didn't overthrow the government in order to get someone else in that doesn't like us. Quickly we realize, however, that you can't have both. You cannot have someone who, on the one hand, puts the interests of the United States ahead of the interests of his own country, which is what we demand, and also have him be popular with his own people. Those are contradictory. So you have to choose. Well, it's an easy choice. So we chose the person who may not be popular, but at least he'll do whatever we want. That person then becomes unpopular. He needs our military backing. That drags us down. Then the people that don't like him wind up not liking us. And we've seen this spiral in a number of countries. So I think that the reason is that this coup doesn't fit into our national narrative. And that's why I think some people have accused me of being anti-American, because I'm telling this story and I'm trying to say that it was a big mistake. And my answer is, and I say this when I'm talking about Iran today and about whatever I talk about in the world, is that if I have a political, I don't really have a political ideology, but if I have something that links my views of the world, it is that America should do what's good for America. That's fine. Every other country does this. I'm not against this at all. In fact, America is probably the only country in the world where citizens don't like to hear this. You know, the French or the Turks or anyone else is perfectly happy thinking, yeah, we did it. It may not be so nice, but it was for France. So who else is going to do things that are good for France if not France? Americans don't like to imagine that we would ever be so base as to do anything that would be in our own interest. We only do it in the interest of world peace and human rights and so forth. So I'm all for America doing what's good for America. All I want is let America stop and think what's really good for us over the long run and not do things that seem like they're good for us in the short run that wind up having terrible consequences in the long run, which is the perfect description of the Mossadegh coup.
So the circumstances you described where a leader can either be popular with his own people or with the interests of the United States ahead. I think the current model of Iran is actually pretty funny because it fulfills neither.
It's neither one, right?
It's neither. At least before, or at least
since June.
It was one of them. One seems to be better than none. My question to you is twofold, though. The first thing is about, in doing research, and I guess this has more to do with face-to-face interaction or actual, you know, talking to people who are involved, do they ever express, like, regret, remorse? What were the actual feelings like?
I mean, mm-hmm. Good question.
Was it more of a detached sort of, just in terms of pure policy, well, it was bad because, you know, things didn't turn out the way they did, and now Iran wants to get their weapons, and, you know, perhaps if we had done something differently, this wouldn't happen. Is it that, or is it more of a feeling of, you know, actual sort of remorse?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it a third option, and have you encountered people who say would defend the overthrow? That's the first question. The second question
Let me answer that first.
Sure, go ahead.
Otherwise, I'll forget it. I have that disease. What does it happen when you forget? You get older, you start forgetting things. I forget the name of it.
Old-timer.
That's it. Thanks. First of all, most interesting case is Kermit Roosevelt. Kermit Roosevelt had died by the time I started writing my book. Nonetheless, he has two sons. One of them was a politician in Massachusetts, a state senator, ran for governor against Bill Weld. I believe he's now the superintendent of schools in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia. And I had dinner with him. So I took him out to dinner to ask him on the subject. I wanted to learn about his father and personal habits. And it's actually really interesting because he told me, I said to him, your father was like a real James Bond. It was amazing what he was able to do and how he manipulated. And then the coup failed and they wanted him to come back to Washington. He said, no, I'm going to do it. I can then he was a master. And this guy said, this is so weird to hear because my father was a total bumbler. My father could not change a light bulb. He couldn't do anything. He was a complete clumsy guy. So I guess he found he's one of those idiot savants, maybe, overthrowing governments was his métier. He told me that to his dying day, my father maintained that the coup was a good thing. He always defended it. He died in 2000. And he said, this coup has also caused a sort of a breach in our family between me and my brother. Because my brother agrees with my father, thinks it was a great thing. I think it was a terrible thing. And this has caused a real problem in our family. The agents that I talked to, I guess, would fit into the category of sort of looking back and saying, well, later history didn't turn out quite as we might have hoped. But I wouldn't say remorse would be the right word. I'd say they had two reactions. One was, it wasn't us. The political decisions were made at another level. Was it a good idea to do it? This wasn't anything I decided. And I think this is really true. I do think the CIA gets a bad rap. All of these coups, and the Mossadegh coup is a perfect example of it, were carried out fully authorized under the laws of the United States from the highest officials, including the President of the United States and the Secretary of State and the Director of Central Intelligence. The rogue elephant CIA is a fantasy. There is no such thing. Certainly in the case of the Mossadegh coup, it was 100% legally authorized. So if you're angry, you shouldn't be angry at Kermit Roosevelt. That's, I guess, what these guys would say. And the other thing that I think they would say is, easy for you now, the Soviet Union is gone, and it looks, we now see the Soviet Union is a lot weaker than we thought, and there was no nuclear war, actually, and so why were we so panicked? You should have been alive. You should have been around in the early 1950s. They were fighting to take over Greece. Communist labor unions were about to win elections in France and Italy. The communists had brutally taken over Poland and Czechoslovakia and all of Eastern Europe. The Soviets had the bomb. The communists had taken over China. They were killing American soldiers in Korea. They were expanding. We could not have sustained them taking over Iran, the oil that it had, the warm water ports. Thanks a lot for being here in the modern age and saying, you made a big mistake. But you got to put yourself back in the time. And this is an argument for which I have some sympathy. I do think it's important to judge people's actions in the context in which they lived. Did Dulles, who I think was probably the key figure here, John Foster Dulles, have enough of an open mind to make a real balanced judgment, or did he come in to office fanatically narrow-minded and blinded? Certainly it was the latter. So yeah, I would blame him for not seeing the world. It's not that the world necessarily was that way, but a certain tendency took over in the United States that saw the world that way, and there was good reason for that. I mean, they may have been wrong, but they were wrong. You could have made a very good case for that, and people like Dulles certainly did. So they are a little bit chagrined at the kind of we know better now view of little whippersnappers like me that want to try to tell them, they made a big mistake. And a little bit irritated, I think it would be a good description of the attitude of some of these MI6 people that I talked to that now are being posited as the guys that created September 11th and, Muslim terrorism all over the world. They're saying, wait a minute, you got to put yourself back there and imagine what the counter scenario could have been. And your other question?
Well, just briefly in response to that, I would say that that would be very much more convincing if, in fact, they weren't doing the very same thing now. button.
Of course, it's different people now. Right, these right, people right. will now be saying the same thing 50 years from now.
The second question, though, actually does have to do with sort of immediate political decisions. Because I've heard a line of argumentation that goes that, in fact, what happened in 1951 was not really the important thing, and that, in fact, 1905 was really, the Constitutional Revolution was really more important than anything that happened in 51, because the seeds of sort of discontent were originally sown there and weren't actually, you know, so 51 was a little premature. I'm just wondering, it's been a while since I've actually had a chance to take a look at your book, because I don't have it with me yet.
Shocked!
I'm wondering if in your research you came across any, I guess, significant connections between 1905 and 1951, because, I mean, you know, you mentioned that people ignore 1951, but if there's anything they ignore more than that, it's probably 1905.
Well, you're going to love my next book. I'm going to make a pitch right here. I have a book coming out in June called Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. About two-thirds of the book, or three-quarters of the book, is a chronicle of the development of democracy in Iran and Turkey over the 20th century. The opening scene is Howard Baskerville. I'm now an expert. I know every detail about Baskerville and who he was and what happened to him. And then Morgan Schuster turns up as another big figure. As far as the Constitutional Revolution goes, I agree with you. There's no doubt that that was a huge turning point that did for Iran what Tanzimat reforms and Young Turks and then Atatürk did for Turkey. It's what separates those countries from all the other countries in that neighborhood. Iran has had a constitution since 1906, and Saudi Arabia and all of our so-called allies have never even had one at all. So no doubt that Mossadegh is a child of the Constitutional Revolution. You know that he had two political careers. So he had a political career in the 1920s when he was still a very young man. You know, he was the finance minister of Fars province when he was 16 years old. His father had been the Qajar finance minister for 30 years. And, in Iran, in many traditional societies, it's normal for people to go into their parents' professions. But finance minister is not such an easy one to learn. But already, I mean, I saw quotes in books that I found assessing Mossadegh when he was 16, 18, and people were so impressed with him. He is destined to be one of the great ones. He went off to Switzerland. He was highly educated. He was probably the most highly educated Iranian in his life. He was the first Iranian ever to win a PhD in law at a European university. So he came back and he was offered governorships. And I think his uncle was the Farman Farmayan, Prince Farman Farmayan, who wanted him to go into the government in Tehran. He didn't want to do that because he didn't want to have any taint of nepotism. He ran for parliament. First time he was elected, he couldn't be seated because he was too young, even though he was elected. Then he did serve in the parliament. And when Reza Khan, you know the story that Reza Khan wanted to have a republic. He wanted to do what Atatürk had done in Turkey, but that didn't work because the clergy wouldn't allow it. They were about to allow it until they got the news from Istanbul that Atatürk had abolished the caliphate. Unbelievable! Like the president of Italy abolishing the papacy and sending the pope off on a boat. Just unthinkable. So once the Iranian Shiite clergy heard about that, they decided this republic thing is coming right from the devil. Just parenthetically, there's a big difference. There was the main real important reason why Atatürk was able to do this and Reza was not, and that is that Sunni clergy had been very intimately involved with the regime for 500 years. Subservience to power was an integral part of the Sunni clergy in Turkey. And so power says, we hate you. You have no power anymore. Okay, we bow down. And they participated actively in their own liquidation. Atatürk had a great line, which I put in my book. Islam, this absurd theology of an immoral Bedouin, is a rotting corpse that poisons our lives. He had a few gentle criticisms of Islam. And the Islamic clergy said, okay, fine, yeah, we agree. Sure, whatever you say. Shiite clergy has a totally different heritage.
justice in the leaders, very important, and you don't bow down. In fact, that's one of the big problems you're seeing in Iran right now. People are accusing the clergy of having abandoned the traditional role of being the one that points the finger at corrupt power. Anyway, that's a nice little digression. So Reza Khan had wanted to establish a republic and become president. That didn't work. So his plan B was, I'll become the Shah. And he submitted this bill to the Majlis. Only three members of the Majlis voted against it. One was the very young Swiss-educated Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, who said that placing so much power in the hands of one man would create a form of corruption so extreme that it is not even known in Zanzibar. After that, soon after Reza became Shah, in the next elections, which I believe were 1924, he arranged that all the people that had criticized him could not be were going to lose the election. That happened to Mossadegh. And Mossadegh was very much of a... He was not a rebel in the sense that he was going to go off into the streets and protest this. His attitude was fine. You want to be king? Country's going to go to hell? I'm out. I'm going back to my farm. You're never going to hear from me again. And sure enough, that's what happened. He actually had the plan to move to Switzerland and become a Swiss citizen, and he actually applied, but he could have done it. But the laws had changed in the interim, and somebody didn't quite qualify anymore. So he stayed in Iran, and for 20 years, more than 20 years, nobody ever heard his name. And he was just finished. He had a political career, lasted a few years. He had served two terms in the Majlis, and that was it. Only after the Second World War, suddenly the Shah is gone, the British are gone, the lid is off, and the promise of the constitutional revolution, which had brought Mossadegh to power the first time and had been interrupted for this quarter century under Reza, could be made real again. So there's the connection between Mossadegh and the constitutional revolution is immutable. It's essential. There could have been no Mossadegh without the constitutional revolution.
That's excellent. Thank you. I know you say you take a lot of questions about the last chapter of all the Shahs, man, and I don't want to pile on that too much. But you talk about this as one of the single most important events in a line that leads to the development of radicalism in the Islamic world. And would you say that this event sort of triggers, this coup triggers a chain of events that lead to it, or are you incorporating other developments going on at the time when you say that? Because, I mean, the Fedayeen-e Islam had already been active in Iran, had assassinated...
They killed Razmara, yeah.
And it was also very much a rejection of Arab dictatorships, too. So I'm wondering how much you see this as one case, one cause out of many, or if you see this as a primary...
I would certainly not say that it's the sole cause or even that it's the main cause. But think of the reasons that I gave earlier. I mean, it did help. It was not so much the coup, but the Shah's increasing repression, which the coup made possible, that created an explosion that really shook the Islamic world. And you're absolutely right that the Arab nationalism played a big role and the Israel-Palestine conflict played a huge role. Nonetheless... in addition to the specific episodes of it of getting into Afghanistan and getting the Americans involved in Iran and so forth, I think it had an electrifying effect on Islamic radicals in many countries, because these people, in many cases, had consigned themselves to the fate of sitting in the corners of mosques muttering about how evil the Pharaoh was. And suddenly, when the news came from Iran, they thought, we don't have to be marginalized. We're not a tiny little faction. We can seize state power. I don't think that this really had ever seemed possible to them before. That traditionalist, or what we call radical fundamentalist Islamic clergy, could influence or even take control of a whole national government. This was an electrifying electrifying aspect of the news that came out of Iran in 1979 and through that whole year, not just the moment of the revolution, but at the beginning it wasn't so clear what kind of a regime was going to emerge. But when that regime did emerge, I do think it started a lot of minds turning, including in countries where they want to kill every Shiite in the world. It wasn't just the fact that they were Shiites, you know, might have limited them, but it didn't. I think in other countries, it had an electrifying effect, and it convinced them that there's no limit to what we can do. We can go out in the street. We can mobilize. There could be a popular base for what we believe because of the repression or backwardness of the regimes we're fighting against. So, of course, I wouldn't want to say this was the defining incident or even one of the... But I do think it was very important. I do think that it, if you are trying... If you were going to write a book in which you were starting from September 11th, and then you want to do... I don't know how many of you are familiar with CIA speak. I've become very familiar with it in my research. I do a... Maybe I understated the amount of source reading that I do. In the CIA, they have this term called walking back the cat. You ever heard that? So if something happens, then you want to... Like what just happened in Afghanistan when that guy blew up the CIA agents. Now what they're doing in Langley is they're walking back the cat. They're trying to figure out, so how did... What led to that? And then what led to that? And what was before that? So what was the beginning of all this? If you were going to write a book in which the beginning, the opening scene is September 11th tragedy, and then you walk back the cat, there'd have to be a chapter on the Mossadegh coup. That wouldn't be the whole book, but I think it would be part of it.
I had a quick question. That something that really caught my eye when you said that Mossadegh in the 1950s, like the language that the American media was using to describe him is like this wizard, like cunning wizard or a frenzied fanatic or painting fanatic, you said, which is so similar to the language that's used to describe Iran's leadership now, even though they're completely opposite ends of the spectrum in many ways. Like, Mossadegh was, like, secular and Western educated and, you know... I was wondering, you may not have an answer for this, it depends on how much Mossadegh has remained in the Western press consciousness since the coup, but I was wondering, has there been a shift in the way that, like, with that benefit of hindsight, of any sort of retrospective reports about Mossadegh, like, describing him in a different way?
That's
because
a good question.
It's so interesting that he was turned into a very emotional, irrational person, even though like he was a very different kind of personality than
right.
What you would line up with Khomeini.
One thing I notice in studying American history and the way the American public responds to challenges from other countries is that Americans love a demon. We don't like to be opposed to an idea or an ideology or a coalition or even a country. There's got to be a person. We love this. Maybe it's the Hollywood thing. I don't know. We love to have one guy who's responsible for everything. Everything bad. Someone that we can hate. You know, I mean, we've had a whole series. We had Castro and Mao and there have been so many. Khomeini was a great example. And I think Mossadegh was too. A person that's outside our cultural context is easy to depict as a wacko because I think we do have, although we're sort of multiculturalists, we preach that, we still have some remnants of this social Darwinist view of the world that there are certain races that are more advanced and more sophisticated, and then there's the primitive backward people. So that makes it easy for us to portray foreign leaders as kind of crazy people. That explains it. I mean, why else would anyone want to be against the United States? Now, as for your question about the way Mossadegh is portrayed today...
If he is at all.
I do think it's changed, and I do think he is portrayed, and I'm really going to go out on a limb and say I think I'm partly responsible for it. When I said that most Americans today who have heard of Mossadegh have probably heard about him from my book, I think that's also true of journalists. And I'll tell you a little story that happened to me just a couple of months ago. I was one of the people invited to the dinner with Ahmadinejad in New York when he came in September or October. We had to wait outside in the lobby because his security was doing what they call the last sweep. Which they claimed that they were trying to make sure there were no bugs in there. I guess they were trying to actually think it was probably the opposite. Make sure they were working. But anyway, we had to wait outside, so we had all these eminent diplomats, so Tom Pickering and very big figures who had been invited and kind of milling around. And I noticed standing near me George Stephanopoulos. So I have never met him. So I went over to him. And I started chatting and, you know, vaguely introducing myself. And he, I'm sure he gets approached at the airport and everything all the time since he's on TV. His face is very familiar. And he was a little bit, just as standoffish as I'm sure I would be if I was constantly being approached by people. But I was not so easily discouraged. And suddenly he said, "You wrote that book, All Shaw's Men." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh, I love that book." He said, "I have that book next to my, right next to my computer. I refer to it regularly, and the person who told me to buy it said, you cannot understand Iran today if you don't read that book." And you know who that person was? John Kerry. Sure enough, I have met with Kerry, and he brought a copy of the book. I didn't even give it to him, and asked me to sign it to him. So now I see references to Mossadegh that are more respectful. He is no longer depicted as the fainting fanatic or wacko. And I do think if there's a narrative about him, that might be a little bit strong, but if people like George Stephanopoulos have some image of him, I think it is the correct one, which is, boy, we sure could love to have Mossadegh back now, and boy, that was probably a big mistake. With that, I think, goes a respect for Mossadegh as a figure. And again, I don't know whether I captured him correctly or not, and actually I'd like to think I did, but for better or worse, the way that I portrayed him is the way that most people in America who know about him know about him. So their view of him is my view, because that's the only thing they've read. And whether putting aside the issue of whether I was accurate or not, I did portray him in a way as being a very respectable and interesting figure. So I think that has now entered into the journalistic narrative as well. And I'll just one other footnote is, don't forget, Madeleine Albright made a kind of quasi-apology in 2000, and even Mr. President Barack Obama has indirectly referred to the fact that we did do something in 1953, and maybe it wasn't such a good idea. And so I think there's something of this bubbling into the consciousness.
I was going to say, just as a comment, that an interesting corollary to this might be to look at the way Gamal Abdel Nasser was portrayed in the 60s, because he and Mossadegh were both very, very similar in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. but being very charismatic and very, like, very nationalist and a similar political platform.
Yes, I would say
and
that
I
they
wonder if they're the same words of, like, raving mad and mm-hmm. Wizard and fanatic would be applied. I wonder if this comes from a tradition of, like, how Iran-specific could this language
No, I think it's not Iran-specific. It's not even Middle East-specific. It's for all the wackos in the world that don't realize how great America is. I would also say, just as parenthetically, that although Nasser and Mossadegh had much in common in the sense that they were nationalists and they wanted to reclaim their role of their national patrimony, in many ways they were also very different. Mossadegh was highly cultivated. Nasser, I don't think, was. Mossadegh was steeped in philosophy, highly educated, erudite. You would not use these words to describe Nasser. Nasser also had regional ambitions. Mossadegh never did. So, although we put them in the same category as wacko crazies from the Middle East, which is a very rich vein in the American popular mind, I think they had at least as many differences as similarities.
I guess my question is more, what's the import of Mossadegh in Iran itself today?
Very interesting.
Beyond sort of, you know, as a wounded national pride thing that people, Americans have to apologize for, things like that. I mean, and has his reputation seen a resurgence? Mm-hmm. Has it been modified in
Good
recent
question.
Years?
One of my friends who was in Tehran and out on the street in the days after, an Iranian who was in the streets after the days after the election, sent me a photograph which electrified me. I wrote a column about it, and I've actually included it in the photo section of my forthcoming book. And it's a protester holding a sign, sort of hand stuck together, and there's two big pictures on it. One is Mousavi, and the other is Mossadegh. And in Farsi, underneath, it says, "We will not allow history to repeat itself." So the fact that at least one person, I like to think more, were carrying Mossadegh's picture in that protest really moved me. I think that every time Mossadegh's picture is held up, you don't need a caption. Everybody knows what it means. It means, "I favor the secular democratic option for Iran." as to how Mossadegh is perceived by the population, I asked many, many people in Iran, what do you know about Mossadegh? What I found was that there's not so much knowledge about him, and that's intentional. Of course, for 50 years, you've had regimes in power that don't want to promote his ideology and kind of wiped him away out of history. Most people know he nationalized the oil. That was the answer I got most often. Sure, he nationalized the oil. There was one period, lasted about a year, I'd say, from the beginning of 1979, maybe to the beginning of 1980, when the window opened. A street was named after Mossadegh. A stamp was issued, a copy of which I had. I bought the first day cover with Mossadegh's picture on it. And it seemed as though Mossadegh was coming back to life. He'd only been dead barely more than a decade by then. Nonetheless, that window closed very quickly. The street name was changed again. The only person left from Mossadegh period who's still honored has one of the main streets in Tehran named after him is Fatemi, who was his foreign minister, who was the only member of his cabinet who was immediately executed by the young Baby Shah. And in fact, it's a tragic story because Fatemi was the one who was very flamboyant and very militant, and he had told Mossadegh after, there were two coups. The first coup failed, and 4 days later they did it again and it succeeded. And Fatemi went to Mossadegh and said something like, you got to take all those people out and shoot them. And Mossadegh said, under what law could I possibly do that? And Fatemi said, under the law that they just tried to overthrow your government, and if you let them out, they're going to try to do it again. And Mossadegh, of course, said, that's not a law. I can't, the Shah's gone. He must have been the one behind the coup. So I'm not going to do any such thing. So he ignored Fatemi's advice. That's what got him overthrown. And not only got him overthrown, it got Fatemi executed. So I often wonder if that was one of the things that depressed Mossadegh in the following years. I don't believe, incidentally, and I have no way of knowing this, I don't believe that Mossadegh ever figured out all the time that he lived, and he lived another 15 years almost after the coup, that there had ever been such a person as Kermit Roosevelt, that there ever was an American who was actually working in the U.S. Embassy and organized all this. I don't think that he ever figured that out. And this leads me to another interesting footnote. I did an interview that I did in my article for Smithsonian, and I'm going to put this back in the lead of one of my chapters of my forthcoming book. Bruce Langen was the head of the American head of the American mission in Iran at the time the hostages were taken. He was the senior hostage. And I was on a panel with him talking about Iran at the National Cathedral in Washington, and I had never met him, although I know about him, and he's also an advocate of reconciliation with Iran, which I think is quite remarkable considering everything he went through. Anyway, he told me this amazing story. He said, I'd been sitting in this stone cell by myself for like a year when suddenly the door opens and it's one of the hostage takers, my jailer. He's standing there and I'm so angry. He's a very soft-spoken, phlegmatic guy. I can hardly imagine getting angry. But he said, I started shouting with all the frustration that had built up in me during my captivity. And I said, you have no right to do this. You have no legal right. You have no moral right. It violates every law of God and man, and particularly the hospitality that Iranians have been famous for centuries. You're not allowed to do this. You have no reason to do this. You're holding innocent people for a hostage. You can't do this. He said, I shouted and I screamed for several minutes until I finally ran out of breath. When I finally paused, he leaned into the cell and pointed at me in very good English, said, you have no right to complain. Because you took our whole country hostage in 1953. I remember at the time of the hostage crisis that people were wondering why this happened. It just fit into the narrative of the total nihilist. The people that would do a terrible thing for no reason, just out of blind hatred. Well, now we know why they did it. Because several of the hostage takers have actually written about it. And what they say is, what happened in 1953? We threw out the Shah. The people of Iran got rid of the Shah. The Shah fled. He was out of the country. But then CIA agents working in the basement of the U.S. Embassy organized a coup, and they brought the Shah back. Now it's 25 years later. It's 1979. And what's happened? we chased the Shah out again, the same Shah. It's probably CIA agents are working in the basement of the U.S. Embassy right now, and they're going to bring him back. We only did this to prevent history from repeating itself. The exact same thing that we were trying to prevent had actually happened. But nobody in America had any idea of this then. So the hostage crisis is probably the central episode in why America and Iran hate each other so much today. The emotions that divide Iran and America, certainly from the American side, stem from this episode, even more than the overthrow of our Shah. And that episode, we now know from the hostage takers, was a reaction to what had happened in 1953. So if you're trying to walk back the cat, meow.
A small footnote to that. December 7th, or Shunzdah-e Azar, was Students' Day in Iran, and it was one of the major recent organized demonstrations. What does it commemorate? It commemorates the visit of Richard Nixon as vice president to Iran about 4 months after the coup, when three Iranian students were shot for protesting and were killed. So,
and do the people now, are Iranians very well aware of this fact, or do they just think it's Students' Day?
Yes, well, it became, ever since the 78 revolution, it's been back in the consciousness. But yeah, it ebbs and flows as events.
Let me just add one thing to your question, or to answer your question. I think that the Iranian power elite is of two minds about Mossadegh. On the one hand, they like the story because it fits into their narrative about how we're always being brutalized by outside powers and the world doesn't want us to develop. And this is a very powerful trope in the Iranian collective consciousness, that every time we've tried to develop, the outside world has stepped in to crush us, and there's certainly plenty of historical evidence for that. So they like the Mossadegh story because it fits into that. On the other hand, they don't like it because Mossadegh represents secular, liberal, non-religious democracy, and they hate that. So I think they're kind of torn. And I'll just give you one footnote. When I was at the dinner with Mr. Ahmadinejad, it was very interesting. We walked into a room. It was like this, except much bigger. So it was a square, a rectangular table, set of tables. And there were about 50 people around the table. And Ahmadinejad came in, and he greeted us all. And then he said, I'd like to give each person the chance to ask a question. So each person, I'm going to go around the room and get every question. I had never been in a session where they did it this way. And sure enough, that took like an hour and a half just to go around the table and everybody answered the questions. And sure enough, he was taking notes. As soon as the last question was asked, the first thing he said was, 44 people have asked questions. He was obviously counting them. And then he went one by one and answered the questions. And he even tried to pronounce the name of each person phonetically, because I guess through the translator he got some. And he had tried to get a little difficulty with Stephanopoulos, you can imagine. But he really did. He really did make the effort. Anyway, as they were going around the table, everybody was asking the logical, obvious questions that you would expect them to ask, mostly about the nuclear program and about the brutality of the suppression of the protests. And several had individuals that they were friends with that had been in prison, and this was very unjust, and couldn't you look into this case? So everybody was asking the obvious questions. And that's why they're obvious, I guess. Those are the questions everybody wants to have answered. But as they were getting toward me, I was thinking, well, I don't want to ask an obvious question because they've all been asked and all the other ones are going to be asked after me. What could I ask him that would be different? I'd like to ask him a question that maybe he's never been asked before or something that would be unusual. Well, I'm considering myself as sort of Mossadegh's ambassador from the grave. So I thought, okay, this is my chance. And I said to him, in 1953, the government of Prime Minister Mossadegh was overthrown. How do you look back on that episode and the personality of Dr. Mossadegh? And when he got to me, this was his answer. Dr. Mossadegh was a popular leader who unfortunately was overthrown. But we don't want to focus or concentrate too much on this episode, because if we did, we would never want to talk to the United States.
I'm going to guess with no evidence that that's the only time ever Ahmadinejad has addressed the Mossadegh issue in public. I have no idea if that's true, but I want to keep saying that and wait for someone to contradict me.
You mentioned that certain people in intelligence said that the United States, that they didn't care what kind of government was established in a country after it. I'm thinking back now on the position of Mohammad Reza Shah before he was expelled from the country, and obviously then before he was reinstated. Do you think the United States government had a full idea of what kind of leader he would be, of what kind of policies he would have? Because he never had the kind of power that his father had. I don't know to what extent the United States was aware of what his positions were.
Well, I have two answers to that. First of all, one of my greatest shocks in writing this book was to learn about Mohammad Reza Shah as a young man. Because I'm old enough to remember Mohammad Reza Shah when he was king of the world, and there was the peacock throne, and he was crushing people and arresting people and the commanding dictator of the world with American presidents bowing in front of him. I couldn't believe that this guy was a coward and a pipsqueak who was afraid of his own shadow. I mean, he was a complete wimp. His sister was the tough guy, Ashraf. She was always trying to buck him up with his backbone, but it was always unsuccessful. I mean, this guy was the exact opposite. It was just like the Wizard of Oz. Don't pay no attention to the man behind the screen. He was a nobody. Maybe, you know, you have to be going into the psychology department to ask why a person like that then portrays himself with this megalomania and this huge Persepolis. I'm the heir of the 5,000. I'm the Cyrus's great-great-grandson or something. But really, there's a dramatic difference between the Shah that we thought we knew in the 1970s and this pipsqueak that we put in power after overthrowing Mossadegh. You know that at first the British had decided they wanted to get this Qajar prince back. That was their first choice. He was living in London. But then it turned out he didn't speak any Persian. So that's when they figured, let's get this guy that's lying around in the casinos in Deauville and maybe we can get him back. So I don't think they really knew much about him. However, I want to make a second point. What that agent said about how we didn't pay attention, really, and we focused our attention away, and then these people developed into dictators, I don't buy that. I don't think that's true. The fact is, they developed into just the kind of leader that we wanted. I mean, we weren't wringing our hands about the Shah becoming a dictator and, oh my God, it's not democratic in Iran. We thought it was a great situation. I mean, here was a guy who Kissinger had this idea that we had to have a regional, one country in every region that would be this country from which we would project power, like the Congo and Mobutu, then there was Suharto and the Indonesia, and Iran was our boy in the Middle East. So the idea that he was not democratic did not disturb us in the least. In fact, we liked that. Not only that, we made this huge deal with him in which the huge billions that we were sending him for oil, he agreed to send all back to us in arms purchases. So that would have hugely destabilized the U.S. economy otherwise. Saudi Arabia made the same deal with us. So I don't think that we would have been able, for political or economic reasons, to start to discipline the Shah when he started to get to be too tyrannical. It might be nice to think, we thought that the Shah would just kind of reign and then there would be these prime ministers, but even the first prime minister, Zahedi, who had been chosen by the British, turned out to be a guy, in some ways, like Mossadegh, in the sense that he believed that the prime minister should run the country and the Shah should go out there and cut ribbons. He had to be fired. And then, of course, all the other prime ministers were very subservient. So I never believed this line that the only reason the Shah and people in Guatemalan dictators got to be terror dictators was that we weren't quite paying attention. No, we were paying attention, and we thought it was fine.
I don't think it's the United States wasn't paying attention so much, just that they didn't understand fully the depth of what he was going to do when he was in power. I think the United States' principal concern once he got in power was maybe some not... we'll overlook the things we don't like because he does what we want.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
And I think, it's possible the United States government would have been just as happy with different policies as long as he was still keeping out the people we didn't want.
But in order to
in order to do the minimum of what we needed an Iranian leader to do, he had to be turning his back on, to at least to some degree, on Iranian national interests. Yeah. It's not possible that there could have been a leader that would have been satisfactory to us, who also would have embodied Iranian national interests. That's why we overthrew Mossadegh in the first place.
Yeah, I'm really interested in what you think of the current U.S. policy towards Iran. And what I have in mind is particularly the reaction to the June elections and kind of the world questioning why Obama didn't take a further stance against what was supposedly happening, the repression of the protests and various...
Well, let me start by giving a little segue from the last question. We didn't know anything about Iran in 1953. Zero. This is something that's also true today. I have a couple of quotes in my book. I have one from Condoleezza Rice where she says, we don't have really any veracity about Iran. We don't really know what's going on there. Secretary of State. And then Nick Burns, who was Undersecretary of State, I have a quote from him in my book in which he says, from 2003 to 2008, I was the U.S. government's point man on Iran. And during that entire period, I never met a single Iranian official. So we don't have this. It's opaque, even to our government. It's really, it's a sin that a country is so important to us, is so unknown to us. And I think this is one of the problems we're going to face when we finally get to the table with them, is that we're going to be facing a whole generation of people that have grown up, thanks to our sanctions and everything, not knowing the West or the outside world, and caught in their own little dream palace. Talking about American policy toward Iran today, I like what Obama's done. I think he set the right atmospherics. He made a kind of an overture. He sent a nice letter. And I do think that he was measured in his criticism of the Iran election. I think I'm in awe of the Iranian democratic movement. I didn't get around to writing this column, but I wanted to write a column saying they deserve the Nobel Prize. I mean, what they are doing is unbelievable. It's so valiant. I can't believe they're doing this. So I hugely admire what they're doing. Nonetheless, I think we delegitimize them when we embrace them and make it seem like they're the Iranian version of U.S. policy. And so in that sense, I think that Obama did the right thing. However, I have one strong criticism of Obama's approach to Iran, and that is that he has never made a real diplomatic approach. He is basically, in the diplomatic sense, although the atmospherics have changed, still following the same policy that Bush followed. And that policy essentially is, we want you to stop your nuclear program. That's what this is all about. And we're willing to negotiate ways that you would give up your nuclear program or limit it. Well, it doesn't make any sense for Iran's side to give up the number one card in their hand in order to get to negotiations. They also have complaints. Now, I've now gone back and looked at the way the United States and China came together. The first document that emerged from that process was something called the Shanghai Communique. There were no agreements contained in that communique. That came later. It's actually a great model for how you start breaking the ice with a country that you've been on very bad terms with for a long time. It has three parts. The first part is the Chinese just write that. And what they write is the things we don't like about what America does, our complaints about America, things we want you to change. Next section, the Americans write it, what we don't like about China and what you do. Third section just says, we promise to negotiate on all the above issues, and we will not resort to force. And it was so cleverly done that in the Chinese language version, the Chinese part comes first, and in the English language version, the English part, American part comes first. This would be a great way to start with Iran. I mean, we have a lot of very legitimate complaints against Iran, but they also have a few good complaints against us. I think it might be possible to negotiate a way out of the nuclear dilemma, but not if we insist on negotiating only on that issue. It has to be in the context of a larger negotiation. And I, putting myself in their shoes, I would see absolutely zero advantage to negotiating only on the one issue that the other side cares about. I would love to see Obama make a more comprehensive offer. I know that Kerry is trying to get a visa to go there. I don't know if this might be a part of that. But the administration is still caught in the foreign policy establishment idea. And that always means that the range of acceptable options is very, very narrow. Original thinking on foreign policy matters in Washington is punished as if it were the germ of a plague that must be stamped out immediately before it infects the world. Reminds me of that great story I once read about Tallulah Bankhead, where she apparently went to a Broadway show where there was another diva, another famous woman, famous actress on stage, and afterwards she was asked, what did you think of her performance? And she said, she ran the gamut of emotions from A to B. That's the policy option gamut that we consider in Washington. And I think Obama is very much a prisoner of that. Now, whether that's inevitable or not, that's a question for another day. But I guess my short answer is I liked the atmospherics, and I thought the way that he responded to the protests was good. I definitely think it was a bad idea to do what some of his right-wing critics were saying. Why don't you get out there and beat up on them every day and say we're going to support the Democratic movement to the death? That would have been a terrible idea. So he's kept it down, and I can understand the criticisms of him, but I don't share them. I think he's doing the right thing. On the other hand, in the larger question of how to resolve this crisis, I don't think he's doing much.
Well, I think this is a good point to...
One more question.
No, I meant to ask you, why were Americans supporting the English interests? Because after all, Iranians had nationalized the Iranian oil company, and then the British were taking for 50 or more years the oil to their country and the rest of the world, whereas Iranians themselves, I mean, they lived in extreme poverty. And so that's for number one. And secondly, I don't think you mentioned the Court of Lahai,
mm-hmm.
and Mossadegh won that internationally against the British rule.
Well, you raise a very good question. That's a. Let me give a few observations. First of all, among Iranians, there are particularly older Iranians, there's an abiding hatred and suspicion for the British. I think Iranians are the only people that still think Britain runs the world. And in fact, I even had one Iranian stand up at a speech that I gave. I have had such emotional experiences, particularly with older Iranians. When I give my speeches, I have had them filling the front row and literally weeping when I'm talking about Mossadegh and the coup. I think many of them have never spoken about it, and that's maybe the reason they came here, just to find their whole lives. So one guy got up and said, I loved your book, but I think I want to point out one mistake. So your book is called All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. It should be called A British Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. And it's true. It was a British idea. Before the coup, the British had tried everything. They had tried blockading the port at Abadan. They withdrew all their technicians, even though many of the technicians wanted to stay and work for Mossadegh. They had been very careful not to train any Iranians in how to run the refinery, although they had promised to do that under the terms of their concession agreement. They had been, just as you say, looting Iranian oil for half a century. The entire standard of living that people in Britain enjoyed during the 1920s and 30s and 40s was totally based on oil from Iran. The Royal Navy, which projected British power around the world, was powered 100% by oil from Iran. The trucks, the factories, everything in Britain was powered. Britain has no oil, no colony that had oil. Everything was coming from Iran, while, as you say, Iranians were living in some of the worst poverty in the world. Among the things that the British did were, first they decided they were going to take Mossadegh to the Security Council. And that's when Mossadegh decided, to the shock of everybody, I'm going to New York. And I'm going to speak at the Security Council. It was very difficult to get from Tehran to New York in those days. And when Mossadegh spoke, he was the first leader of a poor country ever to present the case about controlling our own resources in such a public forum, ever. No one had ever done this. And it was the first time in the history of the United Nations, which was only a few years at that time, that a resolution proposed by one of the big powers had failed. Their resolution was that the Security Council must order Mossadegh to give back the oil company. They refused to do that. Then they went to the court in The Hague, and Mossadegh went there also. And the court also ruled against the British. It was only after all of this, they tried so many different things and nothing worked, that they decided they had to go for the coup. Then the British decided they would overthrow him by bribing members of the Majlis so that you'd have a kind of a quasi-legal no-confidence vote. But Mossadegh heard about this. And he closed the British embassy and sent all the British diplomats home, including all the diplomats who were handing out those 52-man notes. So then the British were totally naked. They had lost their most valuable asset in the whole world. And the guy seemed like he was getting away with it. So they went to the Americans. Truman was president. And they said, you've got to do this for us. You've got to do it, because we can't do it. And Truman said no. Truman refused to do it. And the reason that he refused, I also did research in the Truman Library. The reason that Truman refused to do it, to me, is fascinating. He didn't do it because he had foreseen all the consequences, or he understood Mossadegh and the balances of power in Iran and the region. It was the opposite. He didn't do it because he said, we don't know anything about Iran. I don't know anything about Iran. You want us to go overthrow a government? We don't know who they are. We really don't know what's going on over there. I don't like this idea. It was kind of like Midwest common sense. What are you trying to put over on me? I don't know these people. Why should we do that? And he told Churchill no, which is quite dramatic. Only when Eisenhower won the election, a surge of excitement went through the Foreign Office and the MI6, and they thought, oh, wow, now maybe there's a chance. And sure enough, who should show up in London a couple of days after the election but Kermit Roosevelt? And he met with his MI6 people, described in his book as the representatives of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and he told them, this new group is different. Their Dulles has been making speeches in the campaign about the communists. We're going to roll back communism. But now that they're in, they're going to realize, you can't, what are you going to do? How are you going to roll back communism? You're not going to bomb Moscow. We can't invade China. But they're looking for a victory somewhere. They need a country that they can paint as lefty or anti-American or anti-Western that they can intervene in and overthrow. We need to get rid of Mossadegh and get our oil company back. Here's where the two countries' interests meshed. The guy who was... So the British Secret Service sent one of its agents to Washington to present this idea to the Eisenhower administration. They were so impatient, they couldn't even wait for the inauguration. It was even before Eisenhower had been inaugurated. This agent, who had been the chief of the MI6 station in Tehran before Mossadegh closed the embassy, flew to Washington. Now, this guy later wrote a memoir. He was a very interesting figure, Christopher Montague Woodhouse. He had been a partisan fighter in Yugoslavia. He went on to become a great Byzantine historian and a member of parliament, publisher of Penguin Books. He did many things in his life. And in his memoir, there's like one page about the mission that he flew to Washington. And that page is fascinating. Naturally, it just turned to red ink when I saw it. What he wrote was, I was flying over, basically I'm paraphrasing now, but he said, I'm flying over and I'm thinking, so how am I going to make this case? What am I going to say? And I decided I'm not even going to mention it. Our old argument didn't work. Our old argument is not going to work. Our old argument is this madman took away our oil company, so you got to overthrow him so we can have our oil company back. But that's not going to work. Why would the Americans care about that? That's not going to do it. But knowing Dulles, knowing the climate in Washington, I decided I'm not even going to mention the oil company. I'm going to say Mossadegh is leading Iran toward communism. That will do it. And sure enough, that's what he said, and Dulles immediately grabbed onto it. And they thought, this was fantastic. This is just what we need. A country where we can go in. We know they're anti-American because they're taking over an oil company. That means they're anti-capitalist. That means they're against the West. So, and Dulles had spent his entire life as a corporate lawyer for the biggest American corporations. That was something that he hated. The only time, as this, now I've traced, I went through all the documents that ever in the history of U.S., now a lot of these have been declassified, all the times this coup was mentioned in any meeting in Washington. And during the entire process, there's only one time when any American official raises a question. And the official, of all people, was President Eisenhower. At one meeting of the National Security Council in May, 1953, he says, essentially, I'm glad we're overthrowing this communist, Mossadegh, but I hadn't really understood that he was a communist. And Dulles had a fantastic answer. Dulles said, it's true that he's not a communist, but he's very old. He could die. He could be overthrown. Then there would be instability. The Russians are right next door. They've got a lot of oil. There's a two-day party there, a communist party, even though it was still very small. There was a communist party because it was an open society. And so it's not that he's a communist, but keeping him in power is going to make Iran vulnerable to a communist takeover, and then it'll be too late. And Eisenhower said, okay, I get it now. Let's do it. So with that, the whole thing was done. But it was 100% British idea. And had the 1952 election gone differently, and Stevenson had won, or had the 1951 election in Britain gone differently, and Churchill, who was a huge imperialist, not won, there probably would not have ever been a coup. And Mossadegh might have even fallen by his own domestic problems, in which case the Americans would have never been responsible for anything and not dragged into this whole conundrum. But we were too impatient. We couldn't wait for events to take their own shape, and we loved this British proposal.
Another point which is in favor of Mossadegh. You know, Iran, the Jews are not, they're not, for centuries, they're not loved by Iranians, you know. That's why when the Israeli came to be, many thousands of them left and went to Palestine. Now, a Jewish journalist recently has published a book, 50 years of history, of 50 years of journalism. He was among, in he's a Jew, and he received money and went to study and all of that. Yet he was, there is in his book, very pro-Mossadegh, and together with Mossadegh, he came to the United States. You know, when he came, he was accompanied.
Uh-huh.
And describes his right is how Mossadegh here in the United States won practically the sympathy of the people and those who talked with him. And he was present there that the journalists are talking about.
Well, I know that from what I read in the American press during Mossadegh's stay here, the public image of Mossadegh changed quite dramatically. He became seen as kind of your very interesting, maybe slightly eccentric grandfather that would tell nice stories. And he was very sympathetic. He came across as a very positive person. And I think not only was that important for Iran and for Mossadegh, but it was also maybe the first time that Americans had started to think about this whole concept of people in poor countries trying to take control of their resources, and that maybe this wouldn't necessarily only be an act aimed against America, but maybe there was some reason from their side, something that I don't think Americans had ever realized, and I think many still don't realize today.
Well, I'm sure that we could go on plying you with questions for another hour or so, but I think we had better stop here, and thank you very much for coming.
This was great. Thank you so much.